You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Happy New Year. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author and environmental activist Bill McKibben, who recently published his first novel, Radio Free Vermont. Bill McKibben is the author of more than a dozen books, including The End of Nature, Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age, and Deep Economy. A former staff writer for The New Yorker, he writes often for Harper's Magazine, National Geographic, and The New York Review of Books, among other publications. He is the founder of the environmental organizations Step It Up and 350.org, a global warming awareness campaign that in October 2009 coordinated what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. He is a scholar in residence at Middlebury College and lives in Vermont with his wife, the writer Sue Halpern, and their daughter. A book that's also the beginning of a movement, Bill McKibben's debut novel, Radio Free Vermont, follows a band of Vermont patriots who decide that their state might be better off as its own republic. As the host of Radio Free Vermont, underground, underpowered, and underfoot, 72-year-old Vern Barclay is currently broadcasting from an undisclosed and double-secret location. With the help of a young computer prodigy named Perry Alterson, Vern uses his radio show to advocate for a simple yet radical idea, an independent Vermont, one where the state secedes from the United States and operates under a free local economy. But for now, he and his radio show must remain untraceable, because in addition to being a lifelong Vermonter and concerned citizen, Vern Barclay is also a fugitive from the law. In Radio Free Vermont, Bill McKibben entertains and expands upon an idea that's become more popular than ever, seceding from the United States. Along with Vern and Perry, McKibben imagines an eccentric group of activists who carry out their own version of guerrilla warfare, which includes dismissing local middle school children early in honor of Ethan Allen Day, and hijacking a Coors Light truck and replacing the stock with local brew. Witty, biting, and terrifyingly timely, Radio Free Vermont is Bill McKibben's fictional response to the burgeoning resistance movement. When I spoke with Bill McKibben, I began by asking how he has the positive energy and spirit to write a fable right now, despite the present political climate. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I figured this was the year for it, Shayla. The last thing we really needed was another one of my usual depressing tomes. I have to write those because we live in a depressing world. You know, I wrote the first book about climate change for a general audience and things. But, I think the entire country is living with a kind of reverse dose of Prozac this year. Everybody a little sad and anxious. And so if I was ever going to put out a book that was a little more rambunctious and cheerful, this was probably the year for it.
Yeah, it was great fun to read, and yet still kept all the important subjects top of mind, so that was great. So when did you decide to write a novel?
I've actually been writing this novel for years, mostly just to kind of amuse myself. I've had to travel a great deal outside Vermont for the last decade because we've been building this big global climate movement.
Yeah.
And so one way to deal with acute homesickness was to have an excuse to write about the place that I love. So it is a love letter in a sense to Vermont, mm-hmm. and also a kind of mash note to the resistance that I've been a part of for a decade now, and it is blossomed so spectacularly in this first year of the Trump era.
Yeah. Yeah. first year.
Maybe the only good thing about this past year.
Yeah. I enjoyed your characters so much. I loved the book and how it represents Vermont so well, and your characters were great Vermonters, some from Vermont and some not. I thought we could start by talking a little bit about Vern Barclay, who's a radio man, and his mission that he kind of stumbles into.
Well, let me say, first of all, that one of the other things that's really, you know, there are kind of three leitmotifs in this book, because they're all three passions of mine. One is radio.
Yeah.
And Vern is a lifelong radio host. He's a little bit modeled on the wonderful Ken Squire, whose father started WDEV in Waterbury, and Ken works there to this day. But Vern, in the book, has spent a life as a kind of radio morning host, just talking to Vermonters morning after morning after morning. But now he's finds himself a fugitive, leading this slightly unlikely secession movement from an isolated farmhouse someplace in the mountains of Starksboro. The other two leitmotifs that recur, or two of the others anyway, are Vermont's wonderful homegrown beer industry.
Yes.
I think now one of our biggest tourism draws, in fact. And the other is my other real passion in the world, cross-country skiing. And I think the book has what may be the first cross-country ski chase scene in American literature. So you're supposed to write about what you know. Beer and skiing and radio are three of the things I know a little bit about.
Yeah, you didn't put a lot of dogs in this book, but you seem to know a lot about dogs, too. I saw your recent thank you message to 350.org donors.
Yes, it has our good dog, Berkey.
Berkey.
And it, who loves to ski, too.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, well, now you've talked about those leitmotifs, and I want to get back to talking about Vern, but I loved the beer thing. I loved you mention all these specific beers, and they are sort of underwriters for this not legal broadcast that keeps going.
the pirate podcast that he is sort of using to organize Vermonters, yes. And in fact, it's been great fun, because some of these guys, Otter Creek and Brewing and The Alchemist, have turned out to be kind of unofficial sponsors of when I've been going around giving talks and things, and they've been showing up and handing out cans of beer, and we've had some very merry readings around the state of Vermont.
Yeah, and you mentioned, let's see, Hill Farmstead's Revelatory Abner IPA, McNeil Brewery's very fine Duck's Breath Ale, and Hogback Mountain
Fiddlehead
Brewery,
and
Fiddlehead,
Lawson's, yeah. The Alchemist, you know, you name it. Vermont, I think, is up to 78 or something breweries. We have more per capita than any place in the world. And it's not only that we produce great beer. Beer was really the first commodity where Americans fought back against the spreading homogenization and corporatization of our consumer life. You know, by 1980, we were down to, in this country, 20 breweries or so, all of them brewing the same basic thing, some form of Budweiser.
Yeah.
Now we're at 4,000 breweries and climbing, and, you know, at least in Vermont, if you're drinking from more than 500 yards away, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, it used to be ice cream, but that changed, didn't it?
That's right.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about Vern. So first of all, did you ever work in radio?
Well, I've done a certain amount of radio over the years, but never really. I'm a writer, but I've always had a passionate interest in it, and I actually helped set up a great institution called Transom.org that's become the kind of training site for young radio journalists and radio, you know, audio narrative producers, just because I very much believed in this and wanted a steady supply of good stuff to listen to.
Yeah, yeah. One aspect of Vern's story that I really found very, it just rang totally true, is part of how he gets into doing this is that his own radio station, which is maybe based a little on the WDEV model, is bought out by a huge conglomerate that has hundreds of stations around the country and has changed everything so that there's no local news and there's increasing advertising and everything's changed in a way that he doesn't like very much.
Exactly right. And so through a sort of series of accidents, ends up at one of those broadcasts that rural radio stations do at the opening of a new store. They're at the opening of a new Walmart, and it goes badly in all kinds of ways, thus beginning the small revolution that they undertake.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then you have this great character named Perry. He's the fact and numbers guy, but he's also this great music lover. And I wondered if, I should describe him a little bit more fully. He's on the spectrum by his own admission, and he's kind of an awkward fellow. He's at first a little uncomfortable being on the air when he's talking on broadcasts, but one of the things he loves is music, and I wondered if his taste in music is your own taste in music.
Well, what he loves is soul music of a particular era.
Yeah.
And indeed, it is my favorite music, but it was also a way to try and, I mean, look, the problem with Vermont, wonderful though it is its, you know, lack of diversity. You
right.
know, we're as white as a sheet of typing paper. And that's one of the things that makes it less fun to live here. And happily, it's beginning to change, especially in Burlington. And so it was good fun to imagine, you know, imagine him musically pushing a fair amount of diversity into, and by the end, they're, well, I won't give away what they choose, but Vermont has to choose a new national anthem,
yeah.
And it turns out not to be Moonlight in Vermont and Perry Como, it's something else instead.
Yeah. Yeah, and I should say that this whole movement turns into a secessionist movement, and it was really interesting to read the evolution of their thinking on that, and whether or not Vermont could stand alone as an independent state.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think actually we probably should secede, although ask me during the second Trump administration, and I may have a different answer for you. But I do think it's a good moment to be thinking about smallness, localness, community, strength, and some alternatives to a big system that seems not to be working very well. Any system that spits out Donald Trump as the answer to the question, who should lead us, is clearly not, in my opinion, a system that's working at maximum efficiency.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned something about community and Vermont being a small community kind of community-focused place. And I loved the character of Sylvia, who she houses Vernon Perry as they start their movement, and also then another character who comes into it. But she also teaches classes to city people about how to become Vermonters. I just loved this.
The Academy for New Vermonters, yes, for you who retire here, you know, from some corporate life in the suburbs someplace, someone has to teach you how to, you know, drive in the mud,
right.
And use a chainsaw and whatever it is. So that's the little job she set out for herself.
And the first lecture tends to be about being a good neighbor.
That's right. And one of the lectures is about what to do at your first town meeting.
Yeah.
And the answer is nothing. Sit there. Silently, please.
Please don't
try
speak.
To boss around all your new neighbors. Even if you did used to run some division of GE or something back in your old life. You know, when we try to figure out what makes Vermont different, I think town meeting actually is part of the answer. I try to think about what would happen if someone like Donald Trump, you know, talking the way he talks, showed up at the town meeting in my town in Ripton. You know, people would look at him slack-jawed for a minute and then just tell him it was time to sit down and let someone else talk.
Yeah.
The act wouldn't work, couldn't work when you're, you know, having to come together and reach an agreement about whether the school roof needs to be replaced this year or how much to put in the plowing budget or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. There's a very funny town meeting kind of moment, but I don't want to talk about it because it would be, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but that was awesome. Okay. So as somebody who's been doing, I've been doing this radio show first on the Radiator and now on WBTV, and I've been doing it for 10 years, and I absolutely loved how Vern is constantly referencing the people he's had on his show or saying, oh, I did a show on that. It's like, that's so familiar. It's like, it becomes just like so ingrained in your life, and every subject that comes up, you can talk about how you did a show on that. It was very funny.
Exactly right. Well, radio is, if you think about good radio, really, it's a, it's the kind of ultimate in community. And it's very opposite the web, which is a very niche place, right? You only go find the things that interest you. But if you listen to your station over the course of a day, or WDEV, or any sort of really good radio station, then you're, by just de facto, exposed to all kinds of things that wouldn't normally interest you at first. But part of a community is being willing to be interested in other people's things.
You know? Yeah.
Being willing to be interested in how the schools are, even if you don't have kids in school right now. Being willing to be interested in how we're doing with taking care of old and infirm people, even if you're currently young and healthy, so on and so forth.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, the value of radio and community radio in difficult times. And I was reading recently, the Pew Research Center has published information that basically community radio stations have doubled since 2014. And part of this has to do with a window that was opened up. The FCC opened a window in applications for community radio stations. I think a huge part of it, too, is just it's a way for people to participate. It's a way for people to get involved and to speak to their neighbors.
Well, absolutely. And it's a reminder that the power of the human voice is extraordinarily strong. You would, you know, somehow radio manages to withstand one technological assault after another. You know, television was supposed to do it in, and the movies, and so on. But even in the face of the internet, not only is the human voice surviving, it's prospering. I mean, the era of kind of podcasting and things is a reminder of just how deep that connection is.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of how bookstores were supposedly going to be put out of business, and a lot of them were. But
a lot of them were. Yeah, the ones that have survived, survived by becoming community centers. You
yes.
know?
Yeah.
And that's wonderful. They really are. People ask me, can you buy this book anywhere? Meaning, I think, can I get it on Amazon? And I always say, yes, of course you can buy it anywhere, but you shouldn't. You should buy it at your local bookstore.
Yeah.
In this case, this book in particular, Radio Free Vermont, that's its kind of message.
Yeah. I don't think that I've ever said this on the show, but I probably should. And that is, when I post the podcast, I always put links to the author's website, and then I put links to where you can find the book. And if I were to put Amazon, I probably could get paid for those click-throughs, but I put IndieBound so that people can find local bookstores to buy their books on, and I hope people will do that.
Absolutely, and Vermont actually is it's a great, as with beer, we're good with local bookstores.
Yeah.
We've got more of them left than almost any place I can think of.
Yeah.
We should not take them for granted. I really enjoyed going around doing readings at a bunch of them the last month or so.
I heard your Bear Pond reading was out the door.
We've had great crowds. The bookstore there in Burlington was terrific fun.
Phoenix, yeah.
Yeah, they have great downstairs space and really did a nice job.
So how did you find it, writing fiction? And I know you've been working on this a while, but did you enjoy it?
Well, yeah, I did. I mean, it was fun to be funny, which I'm not usually sort of have latitude to do, and I'm glad that all the reviewers have described it as very funny.
It is.
I started out in life writing the Talk of the Town column for the New Yorker back in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
And that meant, in those days, you couldn't interview anybody famous, really. That editor didn't like that. So instead, I spent 5 years just talking to interesting and usually funny people across the five boroughs of New York City. And I found when I was doing fiction that, since I don't know what I'm doing, I'm not trained as a novelist or a story writer or anything, that basically what I was doing was interviewing fictional characters in my head and taking down their answers to things. One of the frustrations as a journalist is your interview subjects don't always say exactly the thing you'd like them to say and exactly the words you'd like them to use. One of the great advantages, it turns out, of writing fiction is that your characters always respond just as you would like them to.
That's very convenient.
Yeah.
You mentioned a minute ago how much fun it was to be humorous, and I just want to mention one thing, and that is, often I'll read funny books, and the reason they're funny is because of the way the characters are thinking or the dialogue, but in your book, there's that, but there's also the actual unfolding of events is very funny, and it was a pleasure. You know, Sylvia teaching those city people how to become real Vermonters. I'm not going to say how that eventually comes around to have a moment in the plot that helps her, but it is awesome and it was hilarious. And it made me think, I don't know that I always see plot being funny, if that makes sense.
Well, I was doing this mostly to amuse myself and having a good time trying to figure it all out as I went along. And there was probably a certain amount of beer involved in the production of it also.
Another aspect of the craft of writing that I noticed in your book is, I think when you have a plot that has to do with activism, there's a certain tendency or need even to lecture a little bit now and then. And what I really liked was that you allow Vern the thought that, you know, this is not what radio is about. I shouldn't be lecturing. And I think by pointing to it, you lessen it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of acknowledge that there's a certain amount of lecturing that Vern does very occasionally, not that often, and it's kind of a necessary thing.
Yes, he's, like me, always a little bit unsure about whether he's on the right path anyway. I have very firm convictions about the world and the arrest record to prove that I mean them, but I try not to be so absolutely zealous in my understanding of the world that I can't imagine that I might be wrong.
Right. How much of a book tour are you doing with Radio Free Vermont, and how much of it is tied into your other work?
Well, that was sort of what I agreed to do. They wanted me to go do a long book tour, but we've got too much going on in fighting the Trump resurgence, so I did a sort of combination book and organizing tour for a few weeks around the country. And then I've had the great pleasure, what for me has been really fun, has been going doing readings around Vermont, because I can work all day, get in a little ski, and then drive to Norwich or Montpelier or Waterbury or wherever it is and do a reading.
Yeah.
It's especially fun to read it in Vermont, of course, because everybody gets all the jokes. And, part of the joke is on the earnestness of good liberal Vermonters.
Yeah.
So it's been, we've had a merry time.
Have you been up to Highgate, to the galaxy yet?
I haven't been up there yet, but I hope I get to.
That's a great bookstore too. That's another one. That's a far hike if you're going to work all day and go for a ski before you get in the car, though. So, let's see. Do you mind if I read a paragraph and then we can talk about it?
Sure.
So this is from Radio Free Vermont by Bill McKibben. When that yellow came to Vermont, and the red and the orange with it, the colors kept you nearly giddy. These last few years had been drab by comparison with the past. Summers too droughty, or so the weathermen said, but it was still a kind of explosion, with all of April's promise and August's heat building into a climax that came and went with surprising speed. I wondered if you can, as an expert on climate change, talk a little bit about how this will affect foliage in Vermont, how climate change...
All Vermont's iconic things are at risk. You saw what a drab foliage year we had this year.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was because it was so dry and hot late in the summer. We had record drought for stretches, and so leaves were just kind of shriveling on the trees. Eventually, the problem will be much worse.
Mm-hmm.
Birch, beech, and maple, which provide the reds and oranges and yellows, don't live here because they understand how important to our tourist economy they are. They live here because it's the right temperature regime, and it won't be the right temperature regime. Reproduction for those tree species will get harder and harder, and the computer models show that we'll have a nice brown oak hickory forest at some point in the not all that distant future. The same kind of thing's happening with Vermont winters, with our iconic winter season in our ski industry. It gets shorter on average year after year after year. You know, it now survives in many ways on man-made snow, and that gets harder and harder as the temperature goes up. Even the iconic spring syrup season, sugaring season, is falling prey to the same kind of crazy changes in weather. There are many years now when people are starting to tap their trees in late January or early February, and that's not the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, nor are Vermont bears supposed to be in the woods in January out walking around, which is another thing that
that's
you mentioned.
Right.
Yeah,
this may be harder on creatures than on us, although there are some that are thriving, most notably the tick, which is expanding its range with a vengeance as we have one relatively warm winter after another, not cold enough to keep them at bay.
Yeah. Now you have a state governor named Bruce in this book, and I wondered if you had anyone in mind.
No, I actually didn't model too much the politicians on anyone, not on Mr. Scott, who's done, it seems to me, at least a reasonable rhetorical job of standing up to the president.
Yeah.
For one is grateful. They're more the kind of, just the kind of representatives of a kind of hopeful bigness that I find sad. The unwillingness to understand that there's a great deal to be said for the fact that we're a small state.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Governor Bruce is all excited about this new world-class facility with a retractable roof that's named after him. But and it's funny, reading about that reminded me of something that I'm sure you know about, whether you were here yet or not. Do you remember in 1979, or are you aware that in 1979, city officials developed a plan to try to build a dome over Winooski?
I remember that, yes.
They were going to reduce oil consumption and save heating costs. Anyway, I hadn't thought about that in a while until I read about your retractable roof, and then I'm like, oh, they could have done that in Winooski.
Yeah, thank God that reality gets in the way of many of the plans of our leaders.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. Now, I wondered if you had to do research on any aspect of this book. I know that most of it you already know a lot about the things you were writing about, but I wondered, for example, with biathlon training or any other aspect of the book that you had to do any research.
Well, I'm afraid that this is the classic example of write what you know. So I know a lot of great, several of America's greatest biathletes, and followed that sport, which is a great Vermont tradition, of course, over the years. And so, no, I did very little in the way of research, except I had to go look up some of the stuff about Vermont history and learn more about Ethan Allen than I'd known in the past.
Yes. Yeah, and you had the flag developed.
Yes.
That was fun. That was
Ethan Allen turned out to be a remarkable character, it must be said.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess there have been a couple of good biographies of him, but there's probably room for another.
Yeah. Yeah. There's your next project.
There you go.
The book is absolutely full of information that reminded me over and over about how and why I love Vermont. And one example, and this is maybe some of the history that you reread, the fact that while Vermont was still an independent republic in 1777, it became the first sovereign state in the world to constitutionally outlaw slavery. And then when it came back into the Union, it was the first state to outlaw slavery. And that was just one of many things that you mentioned. But it made me so happy to read some of these facts about my state and remember why
yes.
I love it so much.
Vermont has great a great history of resistance. And, you know, I worry sometimes that we may be losing a little bit of that. I hope not. But Vermont's history is very, very, very proud in all kinds of ways. Again, I think that an awful lot of that has to do with the persistence of town meeting. I think the idea that people should be free to make decisions for themselves and their communities, once it gets inside of you, is a very powerful idea and helps us stand up to the, well, to the people who want to take decisions at a higher level, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you did use a lot of actual people in the book, not Governor Bruce, but you used actual reporters and media outlets, and you used Shay Totten, I noticed, from 7 Days.
Yes, I stuck in a lot of... turns out I'm bad at making up names. So it would be fun to just stick the occasional journalist in. Anyway, journalists never get much credit for doing the good things that they do, so it was fun to toss a few of them in.
But you do have a bad journalist in here, too.
Trying to think who. Oh yes, the TV journalist.
Yeah,
that's not based on anyone because I don't have a TV, so I never really, I never really see Vermont TV.
Yeah.
But yes, he I'm afraid does exemplify some of the slightly vain windiness that I associate with television anchors.
Yeah. I think there are great television anchors here, too, but I also think that in every state and in every arena, there are going to be people who are in it for themselves, and he was funny. Okay, you dedicated the book to Spanky Knows a Lot. Does Spanky know who he or she is?
She does, and she's actually the writer who shares my life, Sue Halperin.
Sue Halperin, yes.
My wife of many years, who has a... terrific novel of her own coming out in the spring that has some of the same themes. It's set in a library in northern New York, public library, and so it deals with some of the same themes of community and things. It's a more serious book in every way. She's a real novelist, having done this several times, but it's a really terrific book.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, yeah, I'll have to talk to her when her book comes out.
Absolutely.
So I just have one question left for you, Bill, although it's kind of a two-part question. So at one point in Radio Free Vermont, Vern says, people are so freaked out by Trump, they're looking for something to rally around. And this really struck me. And I think that outside the fictional world, a lot of people are trying to figure out where they fit into finding solutions. So I have two questions. One is, if you have any advice for writers who are trying to make a point or enlighten a reader about some cause. And the other is advice for listeners who maybe aren't writers but want to help make a difference.
Sure. For writers, we always find in all our work that kind of dead serious earnestness at all times isn't the only thing you can do. At 350.org, we've long tried to put art and music and humor and things into the work we do, and it's been very, very helpful. For listeners who are looking to make a difference, I think the basic bottom line is, as individuals at this point, especially facing our biggest problems, and climate change is probably the biggest of them all, you can't really solve them as individuals. I have solar panels all over my roof, and I'm proud of that and so on, but I don't try to fool myself that that's how we're going to beat climate change. At this late stage in the game, it has to come through political action. So that means individuals have to work at being a little bit less individual. They have to join together with others in movements large enough to have some hope of making real change. That's why we set up things like 350.org, which started on the western side of Vermont a decade ago and now is by far the biggest grassroots climate change movement all over the planet. We work in every country but North Korea. So, you know, I think that's the key. Look for others. And 350 Vermont, if I can give a plug to the local chapter of all of this, is a wonderful operation. Maeve McBride and her compatriots do amazing work.
And it's 350 Vermont.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'm just realizing I do have one other question that I didn't get to yet, and that is, what are you reading these days that you might recommend to listeners?
Sure. I just read The Galleys of Richard Powers' new novel, which is magnificent. It's a book called Overstory. You probably know his work. He won a National Book Award some years ago. But this novel is very new and different, and it turns the forest trees and the forest really into characters in a
oh, wow.
deep, remarkable way. My other favorite book of the year was by a guy named Kim Stanley Robinson, who's kind of known as a science fiction writer. He wrote a book called New York 2140 about New York after the oceans have begun to rise. It is one of the great books about New York City I've ever read, as good as E.B. White's little essay, Here is New York, or as good as Joe Mitchell's work up in the old hotel, or almost anything. It couldn't be a more oddly cheerful and wonderful story. So I think that's what I'd recommend.
Oh, fantastic. New York 2140. Mm-hmm. And then the other book that you mentioned is coming out. When would that be?
Well, yeah, spring, I think. It's called Overstory.
Overstory. Okay, great. And your book, I want to mention, is called Radio Free Vermont, A Fable of Resistance by Bill McKibben, published by Blue Rider Press. Bill, thank you so much. It's quite an honor to talk to you, and I really enjoyed your new novel.
Thank you, not just for the conversation, but thank you for the work of helping keep good local radio alive and kicking.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author and environmentalist, Bill McKibben. We discussed his novel, Radio Free Vermont, published by Blue Rider Press. You can learn more about Bill McKibben's work at billmckibben.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to find an article in a newspaper or other news source and turn it to fiction while retaining the underlying thematic point of the original journalistic piece. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, do let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. WBTV is community radio. Happy New Year. I hope 2018 goes well for you.